session number 23370, reel 10.
Could we talk about the period that you were to spend in the Changi area, Salaring Barracks, that you were to be in? How did it compare with your situation at the bicycle camp you come from in Java?
The bicycle camp was relatively a small place. Salaring Barracks was a vast establishment. Where the main area was, they were around a big square, and there were two and three story buildings built to accommodate large numbers of people. I think there were something like eight buildings around that square. There were also individual houses, which had been the offices of accommodation in the peacetime, and the whole thing covered hundreds of acres. It was quite a big establishment with stores and of vast size, and obviously had been filled with a lot of stuff. But of course, when we got there, everything was either empty, and of course there had been war damage there. A lot of the buildings, a lot of the houses and some of the buildings had been hit by gunfire, etc., and had been quite substantially damaged. But generally, of course, it was like a home from home as far as comparison to a bicycle camp is concerned, because that was only a fairly small establishment, mainly built for native troops, and there was quite a big difference in that regard.
By the time you'd gotten there, we're talking sort of September of 42, how had the organisation of the place developed by that stage, by your arrival?
The camp was very well organised. The administration was all done by the British Army or the Australian Army, as the case may be. And there was perimeter guards around the outside. The place had been organised into smaller areas by virtue of lots of barbed wire fences, etc., etc., to keep people under control or keep them within bounds of certain areas. And to go from one area to another, you had to go from the area that we were in over to where the Australian's camp was. You had to go as a group. You had to march across, and you had to go as a group, and you went from guardhouse to guardhouse. You were kept under sight pretty well the whole way. Perhaps the worst thing about it was the guards. A lot of the guards were Sikhs. They had been British troops, but had turned over and were then on the Japanese side, and they were acting as guards, and they were not very friendly characters. They had a tendency to, if possible, get revenge of some sort. They were not to be trusted, and weren't very well liked at all, simply because of the fact that they had turned and hadn't really fought. Particularly, their history, of course, had been of very great courage, etc., in their fightings in other wars, etc., and this was quite a bit of a blow to see them do this sort of thing. But yes, the organisation was very good, very solid, and you knew exactly where you were going all the time.
How will you spend your time at Savarang Barracks?
Working mostly, working cleaning up, and that was a constant thing all the time. This was wartime damage, that sort of thing. And
around Singapore?
Oh, no, around the camp mainly. A lot of the damage also had been done to plantations, this sort of thing, and firewood was always a problem because there was no coal, gas was non-existent, so there was only virtually ability to cook, etc., was mainly via timber. So it was a case of down with the rubber trees, they burn. And they used to send us out to cut down these trees and light them up and bring them back. Transport was on trailers made from chassis of trucks, still with a steering ability and a braking ability, and the only way of locomotion, of course, was two lines of prisoners on ropes and pull the blasted things up the hills and jump on them and run down the hill. So, yes, there was always work to be done, and you never idle for very long.
What was the general feeling amongst the troops at Savarang at this particular point?
Oh, it was the morale was quite high. The expectation was that cry was always, "I'll be out by Christmas." Of course, that never ever eventuated, not for a number of years. But yes, the morale was quite high. The standard of discipline was still very high. There was no slacking, as it were. Whilst we were there, of course, there was the period came up of Armistice Day, the celebration of Armistice Day. The Australian troops and the British troops that were there, most of them still had most of the uniforms, or enough of their uniforms to be pretty well dressed. We, on the other hand, were a real ragtag mob of hobos, I suppose. Most of us had green outfits of some sort, some with boots, some with only sandal type of footwear. As I explained before, the green uniforms that we had been made for native troops and were pretty small, so they gaped and missed in all sorts of places, but nevertheless they were clothes and that's what we wore. One of our officers that we had with us, there were two of them, they had both come up through the ranks, and they were gunnery men from Whale Island in England. Now, when they go through gunnery school anywhere, discipline is absolute, and at Whale Island nothing is ever done at a walking pace, and everything at gunnery school has to be absolutely correct. So these blokes were absolute disciplinarians, and on board ship they'd been known as a pair of bastards, these two, because they were commissioned, or they were warrant officers, which they hadn't got a King's Commission, but they were officers, etc., and lived in the officers' part of the ship, and were known as a pair of bastards. But when we got to Singapore, our particular group had these two blokes with us, Johnny Ross and what was his name, Hawkins. And Johnny Ross came to us just before this Armistice Day parade and said, "Righto, you blokes, we're going to go on a Armistice Day parade, and with all the Australian Army brass that's up there," I stood up and insisted that the Navy had right of leading the parade. So of course they had this ragtag blokes leading the parade. And Johnny's comment was, "Well, if it's the last thing I do," he said, "you'll all bloody all march properly and what have you." Anyway, group of us, and there was about 35 of us, we led this parade of about 2,000 odd soldiers, and put on a pretty good show for him, and he was very happy with it. And Black Jack Galligan, who was the brigadier, the army brigadier, he complimented us on our appearance, etc. So Johnny was very happy, and he was a changed man after that. He was all for us. He reckoned that we were good blokes, so he'd look after us, which turned out was very good. But that was the sort of thing that occurred. You know, these things still kept on going, so discipline, morale, everything was all there.
What was the general feeling, given that Armistice Day was the celebration of the end of the First World War, knowing that you were actually in a Second World War, and apart from all that, you were prisoners of war in the Second World War to an inferior group of people, presumably?
Well,
up until recently, anyway.
A bit cynical, to say the least. Here we are celebrating Armistice Day, stuck on the roll with this mob of bastards. You know, that was sort of the attitude. It was quite not daunting so much as almost humiliating, but like they always said, "Don't let it get you down," you know. But yes, it was quite humiliating in that sense. But it gave us a chance to do something of which we could be reasonably proud, and it was quite a good experience for the blokes off the Perth.
The furphy is still continuing to abound. What were you hearing about the possibility of your future and what that might be?
We didn't hear too much about what the future would be, except that we were going to be taken north, and that was about all that we knew. Well, north was could have been anywhere. The nearest that we could get was that we were going to go north by train and up to Penang. Well, Penang was an island off the coast of the north of Malaya. But that was about as much as we knew at the time. There were all sorts of theories being proposed at the time. You know, we get close enough, we might be able to sneak across to India, or, you know, that sort of thing. But Until you know, or you've got some idea, of course it's all just supposition, and you try to make some sort of rough plans. If the opportunity presents itself, then you're flat out, you'd have a go. But we didn't know then exactly where we were going or what it was about.
There were, as I understand, concerts that you mentioned at bicycle camp, but concerts at Changi. How did they compare?
Oh, they had a very good concert party there. Slim de Grey and all his mob that were there. They were very good with their concerts. They had been a concert party, and of course there were still a lot of musical instruments and that sort of thing around the place. Plus, of course, they were all very good at making up skits and plays and what have you.
There were also university lectures and things like that. Were you practicing
those? Oh, yes. Not only university lectures, but early in the piece, anybody who had experiences of any kind, such as an unusual job, somebody like a miner, or somebody who's experienced at timber cutting or that sort of thing, and had the ability to present his case or present what they did in civilian life. They are presenting all their presenting a lot of these lectures and talks, etc., as well as teachers, professors, people like Ben Barnett, who was had been an Australian Test wicketkeeper, and he finished up behind bars. And of course, he was the sort of person that could get up and talk very interestingly for hours on end. So there were all those sort of people, and they were quite constant, those lectures. A lot of them, of course, we didn't get to, because for quite a bit of the time we were kept in a separate area of Selarang, and of course to get across at night time was quite difficult, because we get to one guard out and wouldn't let you go through, so you were stuck here to turn in and go back again, and it was always a bit dicey at night, because some of these guards were a little bit trigger happy, and didn't need much of an excuse to blast off a few rounds, so it was always a bit tricky. But yes, there were plenty of these lectures, teachers, professors, a vast array of people, really.
Did you learn any particular skills in Changi?
No, not there. It wasn't until I returned to Changi sometime later that we got to getting around to some of these sorts of things. But of course, they had a lot of wounded there, people with amputees and that sort of thing, in the hospitals and around the camps. And of course, they're all people, and they had to be looked after, and they also had to be occupied. So there was a lot within the administration, a lot to be done. People have got to have a crutch to get around on if they got a leg off or that sort of thing. So there was a lot of wonderful skills being practiced in and around the place. And they also had a very good hospital system. So I lost a tooth. in Chang. I'd lost half of it playing volleyball in bicycle camp and broken. I was going up, the other bloke was coming down with his elbow out, and I copped one in the mush and lost half a tooth. So a half a tooth was a nuisance. So while I was at Chang, I took the opportunity and had the half bit out. But the bit that was broken off, unfortunately, had been a gold cap. And as much as I searched and searched and searched through the ground, I couldn't find the gold cap, because the gold cap was worth money to the Chinese. The Chinese, wherever we were, would always buy gold of any sort. Anything that glittered, it was good enough for gold, even though sometimes it was brass.
Anesthetics used on your removal, the tooth removal?
Yes, as I remember. It wasn't very painful.
There was quite a good medical lie there.
Yes. So that wasn't bad. Of course, they were. It was probably against ordinary standards. It was quite pathetic, but against what we had had, and was generally around in the future. This at that time it was quite good. They were still performing a lot of operations, etc.
But contact with the Japanese, I understand, was fairly limited. Was this the same?
Oh yes, yeah.
At this point,
yeah.
You were very self-sufficient.
Gardens. Growing vegetables and that sort of thing. That was very much on the go the whole time. Particularly in a place like the Chang'e area, you could count on being there more or less permanently. So gardens were very much in the swing of things, and very essential, because they were. You had to have something a little more than just rice.
What were you hearing of the outside war situation? Were there any radios that you could get any information from?
You got all sorts of information, but nothing terribly reliable. A lot of rumours and that sort of thing, simply because the... I don't know whether they were made up or people heard them or that sort of thing, but it was just some assumptions. You could always get a bit of information, or there was always a bit of information coming in that this bloke heard one of the officers talking to a Chinaman or somebody, and he came forward with a bit of information, and it was pretty... unreliable, although it was your lifeblood at the time, because it gave you some sort of information and some sort of hope, if you like to put it that way.
What would have been some of the strongest stories that you were hearing that gave you hope, do you think?
The way the war in the desert was going, more than anything, the bombing of Europe, that was they were the big things, and of course the war with Russia, that was had turned and was starting to be of some consequence, and of course that was taking the pressure off of Britain, because they hadn't which. They hadn't gone over and landed on England, so that was taking pressure off them, which was allowing them to concentrate their war effort on what they could do in Europe.
What about word from home? We mentioned earlier on that you'd not been able to get any word back.
Nothing at that point.
Any theories about what was going on in Australia that you can recall?
Nothing very great. We heard about perhaps some detail of the Sydney Harbour thing with the submarines, and of course the Battle of up off the Queensland coast. Can't think of the name of that thing. The Coral Sea, the Battle of the Coral Sea. That was the start of a quite big turning point, and yes, we heard quite a bit about that. And of course, that was quite significant as far as we were concerned, and as far as the war in the Pacific was concerned, it was the beginning of a turnaround. So yes, we knew about that. So yes, there was some good news as far as you could take it. And of course, you used to get all sorts of results, if you like, numbers of ships sunk or that sort of thing. But you were a little bit quite a lot in the dark. But at least you were hearing something about it, and you had something to virtually look forward to.
Christmas. December 25th, obviously, 42. What was that like? How was that celebrated as a prisoner of war?
Another day. Yes, everybody. I think there were a lot of church services went on, because that was still practiced. Religion was still practiced in whatever role they took in that. And there were religious services that went on, but there was nothing extra special, except I think that there was no work required for a couple of days, and that was about it. So I don't remember anything terribly special about Christmas Day. We all celebrated it, of course, but it wasn't very...
What was the sort of strength of belief in God and religion, do you think, as a prisoner of war?
The general run of Australians that I knew and were with weren't very religious people, and perhaps in moments of great stress or great danger, then you'd hear a few thoughts in that direction, but other than that, not a great deal. Those who were had a tendency to be religious, yes, there was always opportunity for them to practice their religion. Nobody ever sneered at it or anything. That was somebody else's business, and he left it right alone, however they like to act with it.
Had there been any discussion, do you think, you mentioned going north, had there been any discussion, do you think, of railway being built up there?
Not that I knew of. I hadn't been aware of I wasn't until later on, or a little bit further on in the bizarre, that I became aware of this fact that there was a blasted railway I had to build. But that was not far away when we, after Christmas, we knew that we were on the move then. We had to go and have a mass medical examination And in our for our group, this was some 3,000 blokes, a mixture of Australians, some Americans, and Dutch.